Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for getting up early to come to my lecture this morning. I'm almost me for you. Yesterday, when I ended my lecture, I was discussing the British policies toward their North American colonies at the end of the Seven Years' War. That war had been extremely expensive for Great Britain, and Great Britain had accumulated an enormous amount of debt in order to get the revenue to fight the war. And after the war, it decided that the time had come to make the Englishmen in North America pay more tax in order to pay off this war debt, which had been fought, at least in part, in their defense. That seemed reasonable. And even in retrospect, it seems more than reasonable because, as I said yesterday, the colonists had been left alone to a high degree. They did not pay nearly as much taxes as Englishmen living in Great Britain. They did not have the same regulations imposed on them, and they were in almost every respect freer from any burdens put upon them by the British government. And yet, ordinarily what makes people angry is not so much how much they're burdened, but the addition of a new burden. And so the colonists certainly perceived the British Crown's attempt to place new taxes on them as a burdensome thing. And in some cases, the new regulations the Crown imposed on them created difficulties for some of their existing arrangements. For example, the British East India Company, which was a great monopoly company licensed by the Crown to conduct commerce with India, had been bringing tea to the colonies, and of course it had to bring the tea first from India to England, unload it, store it, reload it on another ship, and bring it to North America. So the Crown decided to allow the East India Company to bring the tea directly from India to the colonies, which made it possible for the tea to be brought there more cheaply, because now some of the costs connected with loading and storage and all that handling in England could be avoided. But from the point of view of the colonists, this was not an entirely good thing because it now made the British East India Company's tea cheaper and more competitive with the tea being brought in by North American smugglers. So they disliked even what might have seemed beneficial for them, and it was that particular grievance that caused them to attack one of the British East India Company's ships in the harbor at Boston and throw all the boxes of tea into the water. That event became known as the Boston Tea Party. And somehow Americans have always thought this was some glorious revolutionary stroke, but to me it's always seemed like hoodlumism, just vandalism. But revolutionaries do such things when they get excited. And the Americans were beginning to get excited by the middle of the 1770s. Now, many efforts were made to placate the colonists, to respond to their grievances, to try to change policies, and the British kept going back and forth. They would put on a tax or a regulation. The colonists would protest and object, and the British would take off the tax or take off the regulation. And after a while, some of the leading British politicians began to lose their patience. They began to think that the colonists were acting like spoiled children, that no matter what was done to please them, nothing could please them. But actually, the Americans had other grievances which were probably more serious in their minds than these small taxes. None of these taxes was especially large. And again, even if they had paid all of them, they still would have been paying less tax than the Englishmen living in England. So the Crown was not attempting to do anything especially bad to the colonists, but they still did not like it. They wanted to be left alone. And worse, they began to imagine what the government might do to them in the future. They began to think, well, if they've started out putting these new small taxes on us, then next year they'll put more taxes, and pretty soon we will be heavily burdened. So they did not like their expectations that the changes in British policy had created. Now, perhaps even more important was that the British began to enforce a new change in land policy. And I can't emphasize too much the importance of land policy in the 18th and 19th centuries. Land was not everything, but it was extremely important in those times. And the people who came to North America seeking to get rich expected in most cases to get rich from land, either from the operation of farms or the operation of big plantations, using indentured servants as laborers or perhaps African slaves, or, most important of all, they expected to acquire land, wait for its value to rise, sell it, and then gain the profit. So land speculation was the national sport of North America. It remained the national sport of North America. It's still the national sport of North America. It's not baseball. It's land speculation. Everybody who owns a house in a town is hoping to get rich from a rise in the value of his property. This is how most Americans who really acquire any wealth do it, from rising land values. So Americans have always been great land speculators, and some of the wealthiest Americans have been those who acquired great amounts of land, whose value increased greatly. Now, the Americans speculating in land had been going out into the Western territories. The only part of North America they had really settled was a very small strip along the coast, rarely extending more than a few hundred kilometers from the ocean. And even then, only along the rivers. So they had not penetrated very far into the continent, but some of them had decided that a good speculation was to go out even beyond the Appalachian Mountains, the first mountain range on the eastern part of the United States, and acquire land claims and expect that in the future, as people eventually moved there, their land would become valuable and they would be able to sell it for a large profit. So some of the leading American revolutionaries were heavily involved in this form of land speculation, including Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and many others. Washington, in fact, was one of the largest of all the Western land speculators. We call him the father of our country, but it's a little bit of a shame. He was not a completely honest man, and some of his land dealings were quite disreputable. But that was not uncommon. As I said, most rich people speculated in land in those days. Now, the problem was that after the end of the 7 Years' War, the colonists venturing out into the West caused trouble because they would come into contact with the native people there, and sometimes the conflict would become violent, and they would want then British troops to come and protect them, to fight the Indians. Well, that was expensive. That required that the British maintain groups of army troops at various places in the West or near the West, and the British were trying to reduce the expenses of defending North America, not increase them. So they finally decided that these colonists were just causing trouble and expense by insisting on going out into the West to survey lands and make claims to lands, and they finally forbade them to go by an Act of Parliament in 1774 called the Quebec Act. They made all of that area west of the Appalachian Mountains part of the province of Quebec. And they said, don't go there. Well, that was a great unacceptable demand in the minds of the colonists. It meant that their hopes for getting rich from speculation in Western lands could not be realized. And although no one has any way to know for certain just how important each different reason for the revolution really was, obviously some reasons were more important to some people than others, but it's clear that this British land policy with regard to the Western lands was extremely important in provoking leading Americans to decide ultimately that they should simply sever their relationship with the British government, declare their independence, and secede from the British Empire, and defend that independence with arms. As usual, there were some provocations along the way. In 1775 in Massachusetts, a group of colonists actually had a big shooting war with British troops there at a place called Lexington, and a number of colonists were killed by the troops, and that meant that now the Americans had martyrs. Every revolution needs some kind of martyrs to inspire the ones who follow. And so at Lexington, the Americans acquired their martyrs. They viewed themselves as having been unjustly killed, their comrades unjustly killed. And they began to think that the American cause was not a selfish one, not a greedy one, that what they were really fighting for was something noble. They were fighting for what they called the rights of Englishmen. They said, you're not treating us with the same rights that Englishmen have in England. That here you feel free to send your customs officers into our homes with writs of assistance, just looking through all of our property, seeing what you can find, sending your troops to kill our citizens, stationing your navy in our harbors, and putting your troops in our houses to provide housing for them. This is intolerable. These are violations of our liberties, of the long-established rights of Englishmen. And so, in some ways, this was a curious revolution because it didn't seem to be trying to overturn the existing order. In some ways, it seemed to be a revolution to keep the existing order. Some people call it a conservative revolution. That seems like a contradiction, but it did have that quality in some ways. But most of all, I think we need to understand the economic motivations it had. Without the grievances about taxes and the fears of higher taxes in the future, without the grievances about land policy, it's very unlikely the Americans would ever have attempted to secede from the British Empire. Things were actually pretty good for them, all in all. But they did begin their war. This was a difficult thing for them because Britain had three times more population and a great deal more wealth, a large army, a huge navy, and the colonists had very little. So they fought as well as they could, which was not very well. They fought a kind of guerrilla war. What they really hoped to do was wear out the British and make them decide it wasn't worthwhile, so they would just let the Americans go their way. And eventually that's what happened, but it took many years before the British decided to let them go. And in the meanwhile, the Americans got essential assistance from other nations, because as usual, whenever one European nation went to war, then others lined up with it or against it. And in this case, the French and the Spanish and the Dutch decided to give assistance to the American revolutionaries. And the Dutch provided quite a lot of money, which the Americans desperately needed to pay for war supplies and to pay the wages of soldiers. And the French provided their navy and part of their army, which turned out to be decisive in the end, because in 1781, after 6 years of fighting, a combination of American soldiers and French troops and the French navy defeated a large British army in Virginia. And that was the last real battle of the war. The British decided, this isn't worth it. Go, have your independence. Let's be done with this. And in 1783, a treaty of peace was concluded in Paris between the Americans and the British government. And at that point, the United States of America became officially independent. And a sovereign nation. To say that it became a sovereign nation was not saying a great deal, because this new nation didn't have much of a government. In fact, the independence that was achieved was officially not the independence of a nation. It was the independence of 13 separate colonies, each one of which concluded a treaty with the government of Great Britain to become independent. So this was the beginning of a political arrangement of great complications and difficulties, which we call federalism, a system in which authority is divided between different levels of government. In this case, the sovereign governments were supposed to be the individual states. Virginia was like a nation state, Massachusetts like a nation state, and this confederation of the 13 colonies known as the United States of America was a kind of agreement made by the 13 individual states to conduct their foreign affairs and a few other affairs of common interest to them. That was the initial understanding. Now, much of the fury of American politics ever since has to do with fighting over which government will exert authority. Does the authority really rest with the individual states and the political units it creates beneath it? Or does authority rest at a higher level with the national government? And over time, the national government has become more and more powerful, but it was the war we call the Civil War usually in the 1860s that was most important for settling the preeminence of the national government. The states still have considerable authority, but it's clear that since the Civil War, they are not really sovereign states because none of them is free to go its own way. That's what the Civil War was fought about, an attempt of individual states to withdraw from the union of all the states, and that attempt was defeated. But we'll come to that shortly. For now, I just want to point out that the beginning of the country was really a beginning of 13 separate states, not so much one aggregate state, the United States of America. Now, after the Treaty of Paris, this question of land policy still needed resolution. The land speculators were still extremely interested in making sure that they could get into the West, acquire claims to land, or if they had made claims previously, that those claims would be respected by the states that control the Western lands. Of the 13 new states, 7 of them had land claims that extended all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River. I have another terrible drawing here. But the Mississippi River comes down about one-third of the way across the country, and it's that dividing line you see between the areas on this outline. The original area there of the United States was that area all the way to the Mississippi, which the British granted to the colonies in the Treaty of Paris. But within that area, the individual states had claims, some of which were in conflict with one another. So immediately the states were fighting, not fighting with armies, but quarreling about who should control each area of land in the West. And it was very important that in the 1780s they found a way to settle their differences in a workable manner. And even more important, they established a system by which that enormous area would be settled as the population grew and people moved into the area. So this is a policy problem that has arisen in many parts of the world. How to deal with land policy, how to deal with conflicting claims to territory. Now, we can imagine that this issue could have been resolved in various ways. For example, the individual states could have insisted on their claims, and they could have simply fought to enforce those claims. There would be nothing at all unusual in nation states fighting over claims to territory. Indeed, that's what nation states do. That's how they were born in the first place, was in fights for territory. So it would have been completely unsurprising if the state of North Carolina had insisted on its claim of land all the way from the ocean to the Mississippi River, and had fought a war with Virginia to keep the Virginians away, or vice versa. But fortunately, the Americans found a better way to resolve their claims. The most important thing, perhaps, was that they agreed to give up their claims to all areas west of the Appalachian Mountains, and to give those claims over to the government of the United States, the national government, so that no longer would Virginia attempt to control any land west of the mountains. No longer would Would Connecticut attempt to control any land west of the mountains? That land would all belong to, as it were, the government of the United States, and then that government would make policy for what to do with it. Now, the government early decided to do, and for much of this land policy, we owe Thomas Jefferson, one of the most famous of all American revolutionaries. Jefferson was a kind of Renaissance man. He was not just a politician, but a brilliant man, a writer, a kind of amateur scientist, a man of many talents, and a considerable political philosopher as well. So one of the things that Jefferson managed to accomplish was the creation of a land system that was very orderly and systematic. Previously, when people went into these areas that didn't belong to anyone except that some colony had a claim to them, private individuals would go there and define an area they wanted to acquire by finding landmarks. They would say, there's a certain river here, and over here is a mountain, and they would find in small areas rocks and trees and whatever else they could use as a marker, and they would define their claims by the connection of these boundary markers. Well, this was a rough system because obviously a tree wouldn't stay there forever. A tree would disappear, or new trees would grow up, and confusion might arise where the boundary was. So this was not a good, well-formed system of defining territorial boundaries for property owners, but it was the old English system. It was known as the system of metes and bounds, and it went back for many centuries in English practice. Now, what Jefferson decided to do was something very Cartesian. He decided that in the area west of the Appalachians, except for the area controlled by two of the states, which became the states of Kentucky and Tennessee, those areas continued to belong to the states, but the other areas in the west belonged to the national public domain, is the name we've given it. The public domain, meaning the nationally controlled land area. And in the public domain, in that area all the way from the Appalachians eventually to the Pacific Ocean, a grid was marked out, like the grids on a map. Lines of longitude and latitude, and within those degree lines of longitude and latitude, smaller lines for subdivisions, so that one could locate down to the smallest possible level the designation of every piece of land once a careful survey had been made. So what Jefferson's system required was that the national government send its surveyors into the public domain, that they mark out exactly where each division boundary was, and from that, other surveyors could then mark the sub-boundaries, and everybody could work down to locate any particular particle of land, so that the smallest area of land could be defined by its locational coordinates. And that's the property system still used in the United States today, except in the old colonies. And it's very precise, extremely useful, and because it prevented disagreements about where the boundaries lay, it must have prevented countless disputes among people, each claiming the same area. So it was a stroke of brilliance to create the national property grid. And then Jefferson said, what we need to do is get rid of this land. We need to transfer it from the control of the national government to private owners. Well, of course, you know, all these land speculators wanted that anyhow. So probably in the American context, they had to provide for a lot of privatization, but they agreed to that immediately. There was really no disagreement. Nobody said, no, let's not do that. Let's keep the national government as the landlord of this area forever. Let's let the national government rent the land to tenants. Or let's let the national government give big areas of the national domain to important politicians, the way the British Crown had given the colony of Maryland to Lord Baltimore. They could have done a lot of different things, but instead they said, let's provide a precise system of locating land areas and let's sell the land to private owners, or if we think it's a good policy, we can give the land to the new states that are established there for public purposes. And that's how the land came to be disposed. It was either given away for some public purpose or it was sold. And I'll talk more later about the different ways in which the land was privatized. But the important thing is not how it was privatized. You know, this has been a great issue with the fall of communism in Central and Eastern Europe. All this state property that is being privatized, and the question is, how should it be privatized? To whom should the property rights go? Should the state property be sold at auction? Should it be divided up equally among the citizens? Should it be divided up equally among the people who used to work in a particular factory? How should public property be divided? Well, this is an old, old policy issue. The Americans faced this issue in a huge way because they had this whole continent of valuable land, or land that was potentially very, very valuable, and they had to decide who would get it. Who would have the property rights over it? And so they decided in the beginning that they would sell it for the most part, and they would sell it in pretty large units. They wouldn't sell little tiny pieces, but only large amounts, and they would charge quite a bit for it. Now what that meant was that poor people didn't have much chance to get the land from the government at auction. Wealthy people who could afford to pay $2.50 per acre of land could buy a large parcel, and speculators began to do that in the 1790s, but poorer people continued to complain about the land system. And over time, the government responded to those pressures and reduced the size of the minimum sale, the area you could buy at one time, made it smaller and smaller, provided for other ways that poor people could acquire property rights. Eventually, they were allowed to just go settle on the land and make a claim to it and buy it eventually very cheap if nobody else wanted it. And so many people acquired it that way. That was known as preemption. And the price was reduced as well, so that instead of $2.50 per acre, then the price was $1.25 per acre. And eventually, if land had not been claimed by anyone for purchase within a certain number of years, the price was reduced so that it could be acquired even more cheaply. Finally, in the 1860s, a system of homesteading was put in place by the government, and that allowed people to acquire property simply by settling on the land and cultivating it for 5 years' time, with no more than a very small payment for recording the transaction. So the general development of American land policy was in the direction of making it easier and easier and easier for anyone who wanted property and land to acquire that land. Now, again, it wasn't so important how the land was privatized. The important thing was that it was privatized. Because no matter who acquired the private property right to it, once they had that right, then people had an incentive to use the land in a way that made it most valuable. If you own property and you use it in an inefficient way, all the potential income that it might earn, which it does not earn because you're using it inefficiently, becomes your loss. And that creates an incentive for you as a private property owner to change the way you're using the land. If the most efficient use of a piece of land is for some purpose you don't know how to conduct, let's suppose that the best use of a certain piece of land is to grow rice, and you don't know how to grow rice, then what you can do is sell the land to somebody who will grow rice, and they will pay you an amount that reflects the additional value that land will have when used for growing rice. So once property is privatized, then it's in the market. And the market can reallocate it among owners according to whose appraisal places the highest value on it. Who has the idea that he knows best how to make that land yield the most income? And that's what happened in the United States. In various ways, by sale or by gift, the land was transferred to states, to individuals, later on to companies as subsidies to build railroads and canals. But once privatized, all of these owners could resell the land. And usually they did resell the land quite quickly in order to get income to carry out their enterprises. That's how the railroads used their land subsidies in the 1860s and 1870s, by selling the land and then using the money to build the railroad. So this land policy of how to privatize the public domain was of the greatest importance for the development of the American economy. The other thing that was decided in the 1780s was that in the new territories, the territories of the public domain, new states could be created. New political units with equal political standing to the original 13 states. They would not be subordinate in any way. So that when the state of Kentucky was created, very early, Kentucky became just as much a sovereign state as Virginia. It had the right to send two senators to the National Congress, just like Virginia. It had the right to send as many persons to the House of Representatives as its population permitted. So each of the new states became a political equal, and that resolved another issue. The states weren't having to fight with one another to bring themselves up to equality. They started out equal when they were created. And ultimately, the 13 original states became 50 today. But the first 48 of them were created by the beginning of the 20th century, so that after that, not much remained. Just Hawaii and Alaska were added after 1907. Okay, this new national government, the United States of America, started out with some problems. For one thing, it had a big debt. It had borrowed money, remember, from the Dutch, from other lenders in order to conduct the revolution, and it still owed this money. In many cases, it was already behind in paying the interest, and had no way to repay the principal of these loans. So the one big problem was that this government is broke. It has no good way to get income. It could put a tax on imported goods, that is customs duties, but that was not enough revenue to repay everything that it owed. It had no other powers of taxation. It had to ask the individual states for money. So that the Congress of the United States, every time it met, put together a wish list, a list of amounts it would ask for from the individual states as their contributions to the operation of the national government, for the maintenance of any national troops, or the maintenance of ships for Navy to defend American commerce. Now the states, since nothing compelled them to make these payments, were often slow to make them, or they didn't make them at all. After all, they had troubles too. They were all in debt from the Revolution, which had been fought not just by the Continental Congress, but by the individual states as well. So they still owed money to soldiers and owed money to people who had lent money to them. And they didn't feel they were in a very good position to hand more money over to the national government. So they didn't. So here we've got a government, this thing called the United States of America, but it's not really a government, because it has no reliable source of revenue. Remember that? The nation state. It's a combination of an army and a tax bureaucracy. Remember? Those are the essentials of a nation state. Well, it didn't have those. It really didn't have an army. If it wanted troops, it had to ask the states to send some of their militia. If it wanted money, it had to ask the states. It had no way to compel anybody. And this began to trouble a lot of Americans. Well, it began to trouble some of them, let's say. Not all of them. Some actually liked it this way. They thought the last thing we want here is a powerful national government. We just had one of those in London. We don't want another one here to replace the one in London. It's enough to have our individual states and to keep political control close to home. But there were some problems that the states did not seem able to resolve. They started to have commercial disputes with one another. They started to put customs taxes on imports from other states, so that goods brought into Virginia from Maryland might be taxed by Virginia. Well, that slowed commerce. That kept the national economy from operating efficiently. In addition, in some states, there seemed to be threats to the authority of the new state governments. In a number of states, the people in the western parts did not have much allegiance to these new governments. They didn't feel they got anything from them. The people living out in the western part of Virginia thought, you know, what do these people in Williamsburg do for me? Nothing. They don't provide any protection. They don't provide any services of any kind. Why should I give them any taxes? So, in fact, some of the people in the extreme western areas began to intrigue, to conspire with other governments, to perhaps change their allegiance, to align themselves with the British. And the British had never really removed all their troops from the West anyhow. They were supposed to, according to the Treaty of Paris, but they didn't. And the Spanish were not far away. And so the Westerners sometimes went as far as New Orleans to conspire with the Spaniards. In one case, in the western area of North Carolina, they decided they would form a new country. They called it Franklin, named after Benjamin Franklin. And they went to New Orleans and made a secret deal with the Spanish government to bring in arms to help them defend their independence. And unfortunately for them, I guess, these kinds of arrangements took a long time. Transportation was slow. The Spaniards were very bureaucratic, so they could never do anything without approval from Madrid. So first, the deal had to go from New Orleans to Havana, and then the bureaucrats sent it to Madrid, and then the bureaucrats sent it back to Havana, and then it came back to New Orleans. And by the time all of this had happened and the Spanish had agreed, yes, we'll help you break away from the United States, well, they decided they didn't want to. So time is important, even to revolutionaries. But I tell you these stories in order to show just how shaky the authority of the United States was. Americans look back and they think, "Ah, we fought the War of Independence, and as soon as we were independent of Great Britain, we were this strong new nation." But it was nothing like that at all. We're hardly any kind of nation. We're just a bunch of weak, scattered people quarreling with one another, with all kinds of internal disputes, not having the capacity to effectively defend ourselves against any strong national state that would attack us. So the American position was pretty desperate. And it was that condition that inspired some of the Americans to decide they needed to change the system of government. And they held some meetings, and ultimately they had a meeting in 1787 in Philadelphia to amend their Articles of Confederation that they had written to cooperate during the War of Independence. That very document, the Articles of Confederation, had not been finally approved until the war was almost over in 1781. So, once again, much time was required to get anything done. But the Articles of Confederation gave almost no authority to the national government, and the people who met in 1787 were authorized to amend the Articles of Confederation to somehow improve American government and make it stronger. But what they did instead was a kind of peaceful coup, a kind of conspiracy. They locked themselves in the room and talked for 3 months, and they agreed to a completely new constitution, which no one had authorized them to write. But they wrote one anyhow, and then they took it back to their states, and they said, "We've provided for a new constitution, and what we would like you to do is to agree to it, to ratify this new constitution." And indeed, each of the states did then have conventions in which their state delegates agreed to accept this new constitution. Or not. Some of them didn't. One little state called Rhode Island never did accept this agreement until much later when it was forced to. But most of them decided, yes, this was an improvement. They would ratify it. And so eventually the new government under the U.S. Constitution took effect when the new government started in 1789. George Washington was elected the first president, and we've had elections for national president every 4 years since that time. Now, this new government was a definite change in the authority of the national government because it gave the national government the power to levy taxes itself. No longer did it have to beg. It didn't have to ask the individual states for money. It could put its own taxes on. Of course, it could tax imported goods, and it did that. That was its main source of revenue for many decades afterwards, was tariffs. And it could get revenue itself in other ways. It could impose excise taxes, internal taxes, taxes on goods, taxes on property. And at different times, it used all of those forms of taxation. In my future lectures, I'll talk a lot about tax policy because that's perhaps one of the most important forms of all government policy making. But here we have a national government with the power to tax and the power to regulate commerce. In the beginning, people thought this power to regulate commerce was simply a way to put a stop to the quarreling between states and to keep the states from trying to tax imports from one state to another and to allow a national economy to operate freely. And it was. But there's often a germ in something that people don't suspect. And eventually the national power to regulate commerce became a kind of general basis upon which federal regulation of every imaginable kind was based, even regulation that obviously has nothing to do with interstate commerce, but came to be understood as having something to do with it in the interpretation of the American courts. But in the beginning, the power to regulate commerce seemed like and was probably a good policy, because the federal government didn't really regulate anything. It just prevented the states from regulating for many years. Now, in the 1790s, Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the most important of all the American revolutionaries, he decided that this power to tax ought to be used not just to collect customs duties, but it should be used to put some internal tax on people, because if we never taxed anybody, they would begin to think that they shouldn't be. And then when the government really needed, for some reason, perhaps to fight a war, to impose internal taxes, people would resist that tax. So Hamilton whispered in Washington's ear. He did that a lot. And Washington was a stupid man, and so Hamilton was his brain. And Hamilton created almost all the early American policies at the national level. He was a brilliant man, not quite brilliant enough, because he was not brilliant enough to refuse a duel in 1802, I think. And so he got into a duel with another leading politician and was shot dead when he wasn't all that old. But before that time, he had been probably, along with Jefferson, the most important of all the original American revolutionary figures. And Hamilton was different from Jefferson. And their differences are often used as a way of modeling conflicts in American policy that have continued ever since. Jefferson believed in the rights of the people and the individual states. He thought the national government should never be made strong, that it would be a danger, that it might become a tyranny. So it was best to always distrust government. Don't give it any unnecessary powers. Watch it carefully. Never let it do anything without criticizing. Hamilton, on the other hand, believed that a strong national government was good for liberty, that liberty needed a certain amount of order. And he thought that actually the British system wasn't a bad system at all, that if we could recreate it here, that would not be a bad thing. That was an idea that one could not say out loud in the Revolutionary era, because the revolutionaries were full of zeal and hatred of the monarchy of Britain. But Hamilton actually liked the British monarchy, and so he thought that to the extent possible, if we could recreate the British system here, that would be desirable. But he whispered in Washington's ear, "We need to put a tax on." And Congress had therefore passed a tax, a very strange tax, it seems, because they decided to tax whiskey. You might think, that's an odd thing. How much money can you get by taxing whiskey? Well, the answer was actually quite a bit, because the American colonists were very, very heavy drinkers. I actually believe they were drunk almost all the time. Some economic historians have calculated the amount of rum consumed in the colonies in the 18th century, and it comes out to something like 2 liters per person per day. And it's, all right, maybe that's not quite right, but it's a very large amount of alcohol. The Americans were heavy drinkers, and these drinks were part of their food supply. So this was an important product, but most important, in these areas on the frontier, it was very costly to transport goods. So one of the few things that the people could make for sale from these frontier areas was whiskey. Instead of carrying out their corn, they would make the corn into whiskey, and then they could bring out barrels of whiskey on the back of horses and bring it far enough east that they could find a market for it and get cash. So this was an important article of commerce, so important that in some of these areas, whiskey became a medium of exchange. It became a form of money for the frontiersmen. Instead of paying one another in coins, they paid one another in whiskey. So Hamilton's bright idea was really a stupid one, because he should have known that placing a tax on whiskey would really make these Western people angry. And it did. So angry that, first of all, they refused to pay. And secondly, so angry that they began to attack the tax collectors. Sometimes they would just beat them. At other times, they would drive them completely out of the community. They would intimidate anyone who would rent a room to a tax collector. And sometimes they would even tar and feather these tax collectors. You know, they would cover them with tar and then feathers. This was the most undignified way of punishing someone. Very painful, too, to have hot tar poured all over you. And then made you look ridiculous by having feathers poured on top of that. So these tax collectors were treated in the roughest possible way. It may have been even one or two of them killed, because these people said, you know, why should we pay any tax to the national government? It does nothing for us. They want our money, but what do we get in return for it? They weren't going to pay. Well, this was a crisis for the national government in the early 1790s. And Hamilton, who believed that a good way to resolve conflicts like this was by violence, decided that they should accumulate an army and go out and subdue these tax resistors. And that is precisely what they did. They collected from four different states enough militiamen to form an army of more than 12,000 men. And they proceeded to march across the state of Pennsylvania into the western area around now where the city of Pittsburgh is located. And they were going to go out there and make war against the tax resistors, but the tax resistors were not so accommodating. They just ran away and did not present any organized resistance. So the troops had to go around looking from house to house, trying to find individuals they believed were leaders of the tax resistance. And they finally did arrest 12 or 13 men and drag them back to Philadelphia and put them on trial. And three of them were convicted of treason. And eventually they were all pardoned. So this doesn't look as like a great victory for the national government, but it was. Because what they had demonstrated by sending this big army out into an area of tax resistance is that they weren't going to tolerate resistance to their taxation. And if you attempted to defy the federal government's tax laws, they would hurt you. It was an important lesson. And that would have been Hamilton's objective, to teach that lesson. He wrote letters making it very plain what he was trying to do. Okay. Well, over the 19th century, especially the first part of the 19th century, the area controlled by the United States increased tremendously. See, in the beginning, it's the Mississippi River. In 1803, that area from Louisiana, that kind of triangular area that extends from the Caribbean Sea up into the middle of the country and into the western part of the country, that area was purchased from Napoleon by Jefferson. At that time, Jefferson had become president. This was an interesting purchase because there really seemed to be nothing in the Constitution that authorized Jefferson to do such a thing. And Jefferson was always one to insist that the Constitution be followed very strictly. But when he saw a good deal, even he was willing to violate the Constitution. And so he purchased this huge area. The Louisiana Purchase extending all the way from the area around New Orleans, which was a pretty big city already at that time, up into the wilderness. Nobody knew quite where because no surveyors had been up there. And they had only a very rough idea of the boundaries of this purchase, but that was settled over time. So that added a tremendous amount of land to the national domain. Now, for a long time, hardly anybody lived there, but it was available as part of the public domain for settlement. And later on, it became one of the richest agricultural areas of the world, especially the middle part of it, not the part so far west. Okay. In 1845, the United States acquired Texas, that area, a little point down in the bottom of the map there, pointing south and extending up with a neck to the north. The Texans had established their own country in 1836. Many Americans had gone into the area controlled by Spain. And they had established farms there, they had taken slaves, and they were doing well, and they had disagreements with the Mexican government, and so they decided to rebel and establish their own country, They did that successfully in 1836. Mexico was a very weak nation, and it was not really able to defend these remote territories well at all. So the Texans got their country, but all along most of them had not wanted to have their own country. This was just a way of adding to the United States. And immediately after establishing their independence, they asked the United States to annex them, to add them to the United States territory. Now, this became a very contentious policy issue in the 1830s and 1840s. Very, very important. Because the question was, if Texas is added to the United States, what happens to the rights of people to land in Texas? What kinds of private property rights will they have? And especially, is this an area where slavery will be permitted? Now, according to the original Constitution of the United States, the status of slavery was for each state to decide. But if a new state were going to be added, then the national government was involved. It had an interest in what kind of state this would be. Would it be a slave state or a free labor state? Because already those two kinds of states had many disagreements with one another, including disagreements over tariff policy. Because the tariff that the national government collected was one that was collected heavily in the southern ports, and then the revenue that was obtained was spent more in other parts of the country. So the southerners felt that the tariff was a means of exploitation. That southerners paid this tax when they imported goods from Europe, and then the money went somewhere else. So would this be a slave state or not? Well, they finally made an arrangement for the annexation of Texas, but only with great difficulty and a lot of political trickery. So in 1845, Texas was added. The next year, in 1846, a big area in the Northwest, which was known as the Oregon Country, was settled with Great Britain. They had disagreed about where its boundary was. Where is the Oregon Country, and then where does Canada begin? They finally agreed to where to put the northern boundary of the United States at the 49th parallel, and that's where it's been ever since. That line that goes all the way across the north of the country is at the 49th parallel of latitude. That same year, 1846, the annexation of Texas led to war with Mexico. This was not a fair fight. Mexico was a weak country, and by the 1840s, the United States was starting to become a fairly strong country. The population had grown enormously. The amount of wealth and production going on here had increased enormously since the Revolution. So the Americans were starting to become one of the most prosperous people on earth by that time. And they were able to put together a pretty good army to fight the Mexicans. So they quickly defeated Mexico, and they actually invaded Mexico in some places and sent their army all the way to Mexico City and forced the Mexicans to agree to terms. And what they did in the terms of the peace settlement in 1848 was compel them to give up a huge area of territory in what is now the western United States. All that area west of Texas and south of the old Oregon country, that block in the southwestern part of the United States, is known as the Mexican Cession. It was land taken by conquest from the Mexicans in the war. So once again, what do nation states do? Well, if they can, they take territory away from neighboring nation states. And in this case, the Americans could, and they did. 19th century Americans often talked about having something they called a manifest destiny. This is a kind of mystical thing. The manifest destiny of Americans, as they understood it, was for the American people to move all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and to make that some glorious paradise of Anglo-American culture. And that kind of belief motivated many Americans throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century, when unfortunately, having actually realized their dreams of filling up the continent, they began to look even outside and to look at other areas where they might exert their manifest destiny. And so for the next century, they've been looking to other parts of the world to dominate. But we'll talk about that later. With that, the national domain had been almost completed. The amounts added later were relatively very small areas, except for Alaska, which the United States purchased from Russia in 1867. Why they purchased it seemed like a mystery at the time. The Secretary of State at that time was a man named Seward, and the purchase of Alaska became known as Seward's Folly. You know, why would he want to make this deal to give money for Alaska? Because it was this very remote area. There was no conceivable way to put it to profitable use in the foreseeable future at all. And that was correct. It was a very long time before anything important was done with Alaska. But it became an American territory, and finally in the 1950s it was made an American state. And finally, after 100 years, it began to have considerable economic value once petroleum was discovered there. But other than that, it has never been an economically important part of the United States. And it even now has a very small population. It's a good place for people to go when they're sort of down on their luck. Desperate people seem to go to Alaska looking for a new start or a place to stay drunk all the time. So what we have here is a huge area of land occupied by one nation state. The creation of the new states in these territories became the leading political issue. As I said, the most important question was, would these new states permit slavery or not? Now, why was this so important? Why couldn't the southern states that already had slavery just say, well, we have slavery, we'll keep slavery, no problem? Well, they were afraid that at some point the national government would decide to change national policy and abolish slavery. It would change the rules. And indeed it did. Their fears were not without grounds, because that did eventually happen. But they began to have that fear very early. And so there was always a tension between the Southerners and the Northerners, partly about the tariff, which they thought was being used to exploit them, and partly about slavery and fears for their property rights and slaves. The slave system turned out to be very, very profitable for Southerners. More profitable probably than for anybody else, except perhaps some of the small islands in the Caribbean that had the sugar plantations. The slave population of North America grew greatly. After the the year 1808, slave importation into the United States was forbidden. Some slaves were still smuggled. But from that point on, the growth of the slave population was by natural increase, that more were born than died. So the slaves grew, and by 1860, there were approximately 4 million slaves, almost all living in the South. This was an essential part of Southern wealth. If slavery were abolished, millions and millions of dollars of private property would just disappear. And all of the important Southern politicians, almost without exception, owned slaves. Now, that doesn't mean everybody in the South owned slaves, because in fact, most of the white people in the South did not own even one slave. But a lot of them did. Most owned only a few, you know, one or two slaves to help them work on their farms. A few that lived in towns had slaves to do housework. But some of the great slave owners owned hundreds of slaves and some even thousands of slaves. Jefferson Davis, for example, had several plantations. He became the president of the Confederate States when they seceded in 1861. Davis owned more than 1,000 slaves. The average value of a slave at that time was approximately $1,000. And to give you an idea of what that means, in those days, a farm worker worked for about $1 per day. So an ordinary farm worker might earn in a year $300 to $400. To buy a slave, an average slave, $1,000. So the people who owned hundreds or thousands of slaves had an enormous amount of wealth by the standards of that time. Indeed, some of them were rich even by today's standards, if you adjust for changes in the purchasing power of the dollar. So these people were vitally interested in the value of their slave labor. And therefore, they were worried about whether new states would be slaver-free, because if a new state was admitted as a free state, it would send two senators to the National Senate immediately. And those senators might eventually be the ones that adopted a national policy to abolish slavery. So, of course, they preferred that any new states created be slave states. Now, of course, the Northerners didn't like that idea. So, for decades, the North and the South arranged compromises, political deals. And when they admitted new states, they usually balanced them so that one new slave state would enter the Union. At the same time, one new free labor state entered the Union. And this would keep the Senate balanced between slave states and free states. Well, that worked for a long time. This political compromise, despite the hostility between North and South, did work for more than 60 years. That's not bad. Not every compromise works that long. But eventually it did not work forever. And what led to the War of Secession in 1861 was that the South no longer believed that it could continue to arrange such compromises. With the election of Abraham Lincoln, as president in 1860, the Southerners decided that this was the last straw, that Lincoln's positions threatened their interests so greatly that rather than seek any further compromises, they would simply leave the United States of America and set up their own new confederation, which they did in 1861, and they called it the Confederate States of America. Now, if you look at the Constitution that the Confederacy adopted, it's almost identical to the Constitution of the United States. So what you see these people were doing, they were not trying to be Robespierre. They were not trying to do something radically different. In fact, they believed that what they were doing was just trying to keep things the way they were supposed to be. Their fear was that the Northerners were the ones trying to change the rules. And all they wanted was to have the same rights and the same ability to own and control slaves that they had when the original Constitution was ratified. So their Constitution protected slave property. It also put limitations on tariffs so that they could never be raised high enough to be a means of exploitation. But for the most part, it was almost like a copy of the United States Constitution. They adopted that in 1861. Now, the U.S. government then had to decide how to respond to this secession. And it had choices. The government of Lincoln could have simply said, well, this is too bad. You know, we're sorry that our union is breaking up this way, but you know, we disagree, we can't compromise, so go your way. You know, it's like Czech Republic and Slovak Republic. Each one goes its way. They don't have a war about it. But Lincoln represented political interests that did not want to let the southern states go, because these political interests had a strong interest in using the tariffs, making them even higher, using them to protect domestic industry, so they would have been even more exploitive of the southerners. It believed in using the national government to subsidize private businesses. It was a kind of descendant of Alexander Hamilton's policies. And in fact, there's a clear line of descent from Hamilton through the party called the Whig Party, and its leading figure, a man named Henry Clay, who was a leading politician in the Senate for decades. And from Clay, we have Abraham Lincoln, who was himself a member of the Whig Party, until the formation of this new party, the Republican Party, in the 1850s. The Whigs died out. The Republicans took over their policy stance and carried it forward. And so Lincoln believed in high tariffs, free labor, using the national government to subsidize business, a national system of controlling the currency. At that time, there was no central bank. Banking was a business like any other. People founded banks in each individual state according to that state's rules, and they operated according to each state's rules. They issued their own forms of currency. There were some 1,500 banks in 1860 in the United States issuing banknotes. Each one a different color, a different shape, with different words written on it. So you had to have a guidebook if you wanted to exchange currencies. But the market provided that. Entrepreneurs provided books called currency directories. And if someone came in and wanted to make payment to you in a currency you didn't recognize, you opened your guidebook and checked to see whether it was legitimate, what kind of bank issued that currency, what the authors of the directory recommended, if anything, about discounting it. You might say, I'll accept this banknote, but only, you know, at a 10% discount. So these currencies all circulated simultaneously, and the national economy worked fine. There was private enterprise in banking. This is known as the free banking era. No central bank whatsoever. The Hamiltonians, the Whigs, the Republican Party, preferred to have the national government control the currency system, because if government controls money, well, that's a powerful tool to achieve its ends. It can use that control of money to benefit its friends and hurt its enemies. And as a British statesman said back in the 18th century, the whole objective of any political party is to help our friends, hurt our enemies, and line our pockets. So that's never changed. That's still the objective of every political party today in general. So I will stop here. We will resume this afternoon.